From the Sky News Centre at 6, a coroner's concluded the victims in the London Bridge terror attack in 2017 were unlawfully killed. 8 people died and 48 were seriously injured when 3 terrorists went on a rampage, which started when they drove a van into pedestrians. Christine Delcroix was visiting London for the weekend from France with her boyfriend Xavier Thomas, who was killed in the attack.
I thought the van arrived from the front, but I learnt from the police it hit us from behind. My last image is the van mounting. It zigzags. I just have time to say to myself, this is how we die.
It's been revealed MP Chris Williamson remains suspended from the Labour Party over comments he'd made on anti-Semitism. It was thought he'd been allowed back in after receiving a formal warning. A body's been found by police searching for the missing activity centre worker Rosie Johnson on the Isle of Wight. Her family have been informed officers are not treating the death as suspicious. France has recorded its highest ever temperature since records began. It reached 45.9 degrees Celsius in the south of the country. Claire Nullin from the World Meteorological Organization says the blistering heat wave in parts of Europe is consistent with the impact of greenhouse gas emissions.
We're seeing a number of quite alarming climate change indicators. Antarctic sea ice in May was the lowest on record. Arctic sea ice was the second lowest on record. And so the list goes on.
Temperatures here are expected to peak tomorrow. Boots is going to close 200 shops, but says the majority of staff will be redeployed. Most of those shutting are within walking distance of other larger stores. And Andy Murray could face brother Jamie in the third round of the doubles at Wimbledon. But first, he and partner Pierre-Hugues Herbert open against Romania's Marius Copil and Hugo Humbert of France when it gets underway next week. That's the latest. I'm Amelia Cox.
BCFM 93.2.
BCFM. Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to the BCFM Politics Show. Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Conservative councillor for Brislington East, Tony Carey, and from the Brexit Party, a candidate in the recent European elections, Anne Tarr. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, trade war with China. Is this Trump saber-rattling? Does he understand what the Chinese could do to the American economy if they want to hit back? And vaccines. We take a look at some of the reasons people, particularly young mums, don't trust them. Is there any substance to the claims? And the latest talked on measles by the so-called discredited Dr. Andrew Wakefield. I thought measles was a mild disease, but apparently no. It's extremely dangerous. We all must be vaccinated. He has some interesting things to say about that. And then there's the evidence, the biggest epidemic in modern human history. Spanish flu at the end of the First World War, which killed more people than the war itself, was in fact a US vaccine test that went horribly wrong, covered up with the help of wartime censorship. And giants of the global elite, Peter M. Phillips from California. His new book gives names and addresses to the people destroying our planet with greed for more and more money. He fingers a secretive Washington group of 30 as the executive committee of global capitalism that needs to be exposed and broken if the world's to stand a chance. In terms of threats to economic war and climate disaster, these are the people responsible for it all, he says. And most of them, despite the mass media, we've never heard of. That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. One word, hot. for 2 weeks. Oh, that'd be nice to say that. But actually, let's go into a little bit more detail. Tonight, lows around 16 and dry. Highs this weekend, 29 Celsius, hot and sunny. Tomorrow, cooler and cloudier, though, on Sunday. Next week, highs of 22 Celsius, mainly cloudy and dry week with some sunny spells. Next week, that's the 6th and 7th of July, highs of 20 again with sun. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me in the studio is Anne Tarr, who's a Brexit Party candidate in the recent elections. You didn't quite manage to squeeze in, did you, Anne?
No, nearly. Our target at the start was to get 2 seats, so we managed to get 3, and I nearly got elected, so that was very good, very happy.
How does the party decide who on that list actually goes to the top and becomes the first candidate? Because you just missed it, didn't you?
Yeah, well, Anne Widdecombe was first on our list in the South West, which wasn't a surprise, and that was a party decision, so I wasn't privy to all those decision making. So
this just gets, you see, this is one of the things that worries me a little bit about the Brexit Party, is that it's not like the other parties in that there is an element of democracy in those parties where you have a membership and they make these decisions. So, but that doesn't happen with the Brexit Party. How does it work?
Well, I think at the EU elections, that was because the party had been set up so quickly. We were basically selecting our candidates in 2-3 weeks of being founded. We're currently selecting our candidates for the general election, whenever that may be, and that is being managed by existing people within the party and the people who stood in the EU elections.
Is there any prospect of the party becoming democratic? So, in other words, a members' party? Because there were some real problems with UKIP, weren't there? That what happened, effectively, it got infiltrated by Tommy Robinson and the far right, and Gerald Batten, at the top of UKIP, decided to start bringing in these Islamophobic, racist elements into the party. So how do you hope to stop that sort of thing happening with the Brexit Party?
Well, the first thing is that we have a very thorough assessment criteria for anybody who wants to stand as a candidate. So it's not just about getting your normal sort of references or being nominated. You actually have your entire social media history vetted and your career vetted.
I better forget that then, don't I?
And I think you saw the benefit of that, because the media were desperately trying to discredit candidates during the EU elections, and they were unable to do so. They were digging up tweets from sort of 10, 15, well, probably before Twitter started.
The point here being, though, but by being sort of quite secretive in your past and by being very careful about anything you've said, you actually stand a better chance of becoming a Brexit Party candidate, don't you?
Well, I think it's a bit harsh to talk about the past of the Brexit Party, since we only established in mid-April, so it's a very, very short past.
I'm talking about the past of the people who might be maybe candidates. So if anyone has been very kept their thoughts to themselves for the last 30, 40 years, they stand a better chance of becoming a candidate.
Well, I think some of our candidates would don't stand up to scrutiny in that regard. I mean, you can't say Claire Fox has ever held her views to herself, and nor can you say Anne Widdecombe has held her views to herself. So there are two very high-profile people on opposite ends of the spectrum who have made their feelings very clear. And it's not a question about what your views are. It's the Brexit for the EU elections was very clear on, are you a Leaver or are you a Remainer? And it was on a single issue. That's obviously changing as we're moving into looking at policies for the general election. And those policies are being, the members of the public, but people have registered their support for the Brexit Party, are being consulted on that. Sunday afternoon, we have a rally for 5,000 people up at the NEC in Birmingham, where policy announcements are predicted to be made at that point, which have come about from discussions from everybody who is a supporter of the party.
The polls are saying, Martin Summers, the Brexit Party could take 40 seats off of Labour if Labour doesn't back Brexit at a general election. So although Jeremy Corbyn, of course, is calling, and Labour are calling for a general election, it looks as if the Brexit Party are not just a stalking horse for Theresa May and the Tories, but the Labour too.
Well, I would like to know where that came from, to be honest with you. I mean, it's very tricky. This is like a very tricky game of rugby under raining conditions. The ball can bounce in any direction under first past the post, as we saw in the Peterborough by-election, because there were Tories standing and Brexit standing. If they'd been in the same party, they'd have won. Because they're in two different parties, they lost, and Labour came through the middle. This has been the problem in Northern Ireland from 1969 onwards, which is what led to the war.
You asked where it came from. It comes from Caroline Flint, MP. She says Labour...
Well, she's a pro-Brexit Labour Labour MP.
Well, as half or so of them are, Labour will lose 40 MPs to the Brexit Party if it backs a second Brexit vote. That is one of
That's
the,
what she says.
One of the Jeremy Corbyn's.
That's what she
today.
Says. That's not a poll. That's her opinion.
She cited the poll, which showed the party would see seats in its heartland go straight to Nigel Farage if the party embraces another vote to overturn the result of the first vote. I mean, we were told, we played the clip a few weeks ago, didn't we, of all of these people. I suppose there were about maybe 15, 20 politicians all saying this will be the last vote. Well, it was, there was a whole list of them, actually. I'm trying to put my hands on it. Here we go. It's a once-in-a-lifetime vote. All these people said this. David Cameron, Nick Clegg, George Osborne, Peter Mandelson, John Major, Jeremy Corbyn, Sadiq Khan, Philip Hammond, Keir Starmer, Hilary Benn, Chokoramuna, Justin Greening, John McDonnell, Yvette Cooper, Oliver Letwin, even said it, and Theresa May. All these people saying this is a once-in-a-lifetime vote, and now the Labour Party is starting to think about having a second referendum. It doesn't sound good, does it?
Well, all I can say, Tony, is that from my point of view, it was never a once-in-a-lifetime vote. The Constitution...
That's true, you never said
I've never said any such thing. And in actual fact, what's going to come out of this process, and it's a pretty bruising process for the country, let's face it, is we're going to have to confront the constitutional structure of the country, whether we have referendums, whether there's independence for Ireland and Scotland, whether we stay in the single market or not, how we run elections, whether we're going to have post for PR, because of course we've had PR in Northern Ireland since the 1970s, because they first passed the post system entrenched
unionist
domination.
Let's cut to the chase. Can Brexit, can whoever takes over leading the Tory party, can they actually deliver Brexit? What do you think?
I don't think they can deliver a no-deal Brexit, and it's quite likely we'll have a general election, which of course we would have had if we hadn't
so
had the... If we hadn't had, the fixed term Parliament
Act, we
have.
But so that's enough.
Yeah. But so in other words, there'll be a general election.
Tony Carey, what do you make of this conundrum? Can anybody actually deliver Brexit? Do you think whoever becomes the new leader of the Tory Party?
Right. Without giving too much away, I am becoming somewhat sceptical about the ability of this government to deliver Brexit, as they keep saying they're going to.
So we've got two candidates, both that say they're going to do it, and you think maybe neither can.
Well, we had a Remainer as a leader before, and look what happened there. You know, 3 years of procrastination. We got another Remainer. Jeremy Hunt has declared that he would have preferred to remain in Europe, and I don't know that he's perhaps got... It's in his heart to take us out. Mm. There's no doubt about it that should... our next Prime Minister be Mr. Johnson, we will crash out somehow or other.
Yes, well, Boris is interesting, isn't he? Because he's famously wrote these two articles. One was pro-Remain and one was pro-Brexit. So it's almost as if he was flipping a coin and deciding, well, or maybe he was being told by his controller, his secret controller somewhere, you're going to be X if you want to succeed in politics. Because I think there's, I mean, maybe stretching a point, but I think there is quite a lot of this in politics where some politicians just will say or do anything to get to the top, and they'll take the advice of the rich and powerful to do that.
I rather fear that perhaps what you're saying is true there. And I say fear because I'm concerned about Mr. Johnson's scruples at times. And I rather think that if he is elected as leader of the Conservative Party, then in the years since we've been back in power, we haven't learned a thing.
Martin, if just to go back to the whole Skripal affair, because the Foreign Office has been bringing that up Boris lied about didn't he?
Okay.
He lied about it. He simply said that that Porton Down people had told him that this was definitely a nerve agent from Russia, and then they actually took the boss of GCHQ, sorry, boss of Porton Down, to come on the TV on Sky and say, no, actually, we think it might be, but we certainly haven't said. So he's been caught out several times,
well,
hasn't he?
That's one example of his, what's the word? He's not
lying.
He's not known for being entirely truthful.
Surely
is
that's
he?
Lying.
Well, it is, and also, well, for him, I don't think. You see, look at his personality. he basically convinces himself of something and then he just says it. I mean, what happened with the woman that in Iran was he'd been told by MI6 that she was training journalist. Yeah, she was training journalist. So he goes to the House of Commons and he's been briefed that she was training journalist. She's supposedly there on a tourist visa. And he said, well, she was just training journalists. And of course, the Iranians then say, well, yes, she's supposed to be on a tourist visa, not training journalists. And of course, that's what he's been briefed and he's supposed to keep it under his hat, but he didn't know how to do it. And that's rather typical of him, basically. I mean, we're looking forward to a general election campaign against him.
I think one of the interesting things when you look at Boris, what you see in Boris and why he's so popular with the general public is because he exudes confidence and he is a leader. And I think that's something which has been sorely lacking in British politics. And I think if you're looking at the difference between Theresa May and Boris, that's one of the first things you see, is that one is somebody who you would willingly follow and one is somebody who you know will just manage you to the final detail. And the challenge with Jeremy Hunt is that he's just Theresa May in trousers, isn't it?
Okay, so we will talk a bit more about these in a little while. Actually, no, maybe we should have a listen now to a former trauma surgeon. I mean, I personally, looking at the way the press has been dealing with Boris, I mean, talking about the mass media from London, there's been a lot of stories which have been very negative. I mean, I look at those who are going to vote for him, which are people like you, Tony, who are going to vote in this election for leader of the Conservative Party, and think things like saying that what I do in my spare time is make models of buses is not going to appeal to a lot of maybe retired couples, Tory voters, is it?
Absolutely not. I mean, what we want to hear is that instead of sitting at home making models of buses, they're out meeting their community, doing normal things. And this is what is worrying me, that we've got two candidates here who have never done normal things. We have, I mean, hoisting my flag now. I was supporting Savage Javid. I had no doubt about it that he is the best candidate because he has done normal things. He has been in that position that many of us are in now. His father was genuine working class. Couldn't get any more working class than his dad.
He'd make a good Labour leader then, surely.
Back in the days of John Smith, maybe he would have been. I don't think under this current Labour Party he would, but in the John Smith's new Labour, you'd probably find that he would have fitted in perfectly.
The other thing about Sajid was it was interesting to see in the leadership debate, whenever it was last week, I think, where they were all there, including Rory Stewart before he'd been knocked out.
Yeah.
Sajid was the person at the very end that was making, basically telling everyone, look, come on, let's shake hands afterwards. He seemed to be the most collegiate of the lot of them. Anyway, let's have a listen now to he's Dr. David Halpin, and he lives in the southwest here, and he's here. It's about 5 minutes long, but here it is. He's giving his I asked him to give us your diagnosis of Jeremy Hunt, because of course Jeremy Hunt for many years was the health secretary, and he's not too keen on Jeremy Hunt's record of what he did with the NHS during those years. David Halpin now.
I'm David Halpin. I was an orthopaedic and trauma consultant at Torbay Hospital and at a wonderful orthopaedic hospital in Exeter, the Prince Elizabeth. I qualified in 64, became a consultant or a specialist, I prefer the title, in 1975. And I worked jolly hard. I cared greatly for the health service. I did have a private practice, but my job was in the NHS, and I've, in my retirement, spent thousands and thousands of hours defending it, and especially for the community hospitals in the system, which are vital. They've replaced it with what they call care at home, which is nothing like what the community hospitals were able to provide.
The next Prime Minister could be Jeremy Hunt. He was first at the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, then he moved on to the Department for Health. People I speak to say that he's done, it seems, quite a lot to damage morale in the health service. What was your diagnosis, Doctor?
On him, he was always denying the ill effects of their policies. He was often seen in wards, photo opportunities with ward sisters smiling. But I think he's a dishonest man, and I write a lot about the psychopath. And that is, I define a psychopath as someone who has an abnormal response to the loss or injury of others. That is, that they are cold people. and they don't, like I do, worry greatly about anyone being harmed, including in Iran, particularly at the moment.
When he came in, let's go back to the Department for Health. When he became Secretary of State for Health, he was having to implement something which had been brought in before by Andrew Lansley, the Health and Social Care Act. Can you just remind us what it was that Lansley invented and that Hunt was implementing?
Well, there were key changes. They had this model of provider and commissioning bodies. The commissioners were GPs, clinical commissioning groups, CCGs. If you ask members of the public what CCG means, the vast majority haven't even heard of it. But they're very powerful. They hold the budget, about 60% of the total NHS budget in any locality, and they decide what gets done. At the moment, in some areas, they won't do cataracts, for instance. But they're quite powerful. They are not conditioned. They're programmed to toe the line. So I spent a great deal of time trying with other people to save the hospitals in Ashburton, community hospitals, cottage hospitals, as we call them, and in North Devon. I used to go and give talks. I've written acres of stuff. Not one word of my advice as a senior consultant of some reputation was taken on board by the CCG.
So what was the system before that these were replacing?
Well, there was then, in fact, there were about 8 upheavals in the health service since I qualified. Everyone has been in juries pretty well. It was called the Primary Care Trust, I think, and there was a local bureaucracy. Bureaucracy has expanded. They say it's only about 1% of budget. I don't believe them. There's a vast bureaucracy. And the accountability has been reduced. Although they have lots of sham bodies like Health Watch that are meant to listen to people, it's a sham. And they've pushed onwards with a demanning and reducing beds. Thousands of beds have been cut. And the ordinary man and woman, the chances of getting good treatment in a hospital now are less than they were
before.
Well,
some would say, wouldn't they, that all these upheavals in the health service are actually deliberate. The idea is to make the way for private health companies. Is there any truth to that, do you think?
There is, no question. It's deliberate. You have to look at people's intentions. Mrs. Thatcher, who introduced the internal market against all the advice of the BMA and the Royal Colleges, she introduced it because she was, as an undergraduate, taken with Milton Friedman, the head of the Chicago Boys, who were pushing the most vicious fund monetarism, capitalism really, with open talons, from Chicago. And she had her own agency like Milton, a shrunken chap, and Hayek. She was also a student of his, or a liker of him. And they wanted to have a transactional system where people paid up front or by insurance. And that's what they've got, virtually. People are now going private more in bigger numbers because they can't get treatment in health service.
Now, Jeremy Hunt, who could be taking over as Prime Minister, he's did, I think, 6 years as the Health Secretary. But he does have some interesting family connections, doesn't he?
He has. Well, there's a website, a smaller website, which has looked at his family connections. First of all, he has his predecessors were on the East India Company, which is a rapacious, always given a romantic gloss, but it's a rapacious setup, quite extraordinary, really. And it took over lands, massive lands and peoples in the East with gunpowder and with wile. Interesting, Strangeham Hunt, I think, is his full name. One of his one of his predecessors was top of that. We can't blame him for that. But his cousin is Baroness Nettlestone, who was Bottomley. She was a Minister of Health, I forget when.
This is Virginia Bottomley. She was Virginia Minister Bottomley. Of Health, I think, under John Major in the early 90s.
She's now chairman of Nuffield Health, or has been for some time. So you can see that. And there are other relatives who are admirals. I think Hunt's father was admiral. And it's extraordinary how these people, these admirals, have got onto boards of hospitals. But I would not say their intentions are good. What I've done, Tony, is summarize in 3 words. It is destabilizing. 3 Ds. 3 Ds. I like alliteration. destabilise, demoralise, which they've done in spades, dismantle. That is the strategy, and it's being followed through to the nth degree. And I weep for the health service, I weep for the servants of it still, who can't speak up, they're frightened. Some of the doctors are lame, they don't speak up, and they never will do. In fact, the medical profession is rather pathetic on the whole on this.
What sort of Prime Minister do you think he would make?
I think he's got his own agenda. We'll see that the market will dominate even more. The cronies will do well, the corporations. He's backing the Remainers in a way now, but of course he may not get the votes now. But I noticed the BBC have been massaging him very strongly against Johnson.
Well, that's actually, I call him a doctor, which is rather rude, isn't it? He's actually a consultant, senior consultant, Dr. David Halpin. Martin is really describing, he says there, destabilisation, demoralisation and dismantlement of the health service.
Well, I mean, obviously, I agree with most of that. I think the real problem, as Trump said when he came over here, he said, first of all, that the NHS would definitely be part of any trade deal we're going to do with the Americans. Then, of course, he was told not to say that. And, of course, the back record of most of the Tory leadership candidates was that they've written pamphlets saying we should privatise the health service. So when they say, trying to be prime minister, we didn't mean that. Well, it's pretty obvious that that's what you do mean, and of course we've got the evidence of everything that you've done since you've had power, not since 1979.
Tony, we do sort of forget, don't we, that Jeremy Hunt was defence secretary, no, health secretary for, I think, was it, I said there, 6 years or so, and the track record has not really been good, has it? I mean, particularly when we look at what's the situation, accident and emergencies, because so many people find it difficult to get doctor's appointments.
Mr. Hunt... comes from one of these backgrounds that we didn't know existed. But when I was little, people like that didn't exist. They were in fictitious books. The surgeon there mentioned the East India Company. I don't know how far back into history he wants to go. I mean, it was long before the NHS was invented, but...
Well, he's saying Strencham Hunt, apparently, some East India. But he also did say, to give him credit, he said, well, he can't blame him for that. But he comes from this kind of family line.
Well, that's... Yeah, I'm going to sort of probably drop myself in it. Jeremy Hunt's father wasn't just an admiral. He was, I think, Admiral of the Fleet at one stage. Don't come any higher than that. He went again. Jeremy Hunt was at Charterhouse, I think, and educated there. And again, I'm concerned that they aren't really aware of what it is like to live in the streets. Now, I'm a Conservative councillor. I'm an ordinary person. I live in an ordinary house in an ordinary part of Bristol. There is nothing privileged about me in any way, shape or form, except that I've reached my age and I'm not ill yet.
So are you thinking, when you're having to vote between Boris or Jeremy, are you thinking to yourself, actually, I'd rather vote for Sajid and maybe I'll just abstain on this one, or what?
Well, the dilemma I have is that I am, here we go, rolling on the drums, a Brexiteer. I voted for Brexit. I was the only one in my family, I think, that did, or the only one who's confessed to doing so. And I am being repeatedly criticised by the boss for doing so. And so my dilemma is, do I vote for Boris and try and force Brexit, or do I vote for somebody who is perhaps a little less of a convoluted person? When I say, because I'm convinced that Boris Johnson is from the same genetic makeup as Mr. Trump and Bill Clinton.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
I mean, he has difficulty telling the truth. He has difficulty acting with propriety. I really think the guy is, as a human being, is not the greatest person going at all. But he is a guy who is leading the party on my desires, but I would hate to see him as a prime minister, because I think we would have the Ronald and Boris show. The press would have a field day on it. Yeah, imagine.
It's a bit like the US presidency, isn't it? Where you look at the candidates and you think, well, almost you could pick an American citizen at random, they'd probably be a better candidate. Or maybe a tramp from the street and they'd make a better candidate.
We've experienced the last few weeks these various hustlings, I think is probably the word. And Boris has been speaking, and they have all been speaking to the public. The public are not going to get a vote on this. And this is the thing. No one, people have asked me, can I count on your vote? And I've given them a response. But no one has actually come to me with the finer details. No one from any of these two parties now have come to me as a party member who will be allowed to vote and said, the nitty-gritty, and this is what is winding me up a douche.
Yes, well, it's like we're being played, isn't it?
You know, absolutely.
Anyway, Anne, the question for you, I mean, because obviously you're not going to be voting, but the big question, I think, for many people's minds will be, and the question with Jeremy Hunt and health there, is about privatisation, about slow privatisation. So where does the Brexit Party, and if you haven't got an answer for that, where do you stand on this whole thing of NHS privatisation?
Well, I think there are some things which are so big they need to be delivered by the state. And you look at things like the NHS, and that is clearly one of them. What I sensed from listening to your interview there with David Halpin was his complete frustration with nobody listening to him. So he was there saying about all the advice he'd given and everything else he'd given, all his expertise in his profession, and nobody was listening to him, and nobody's paying attention to him. And I think this is the state we are in the country in so many different ways, whether you're talking about the NHS, whether you're talking about the armed forces, whether you're talking about the police. The professionals on the ground, and particularly, you know, teachers as well, but these professions are just not being listened to. And I think this is a real crisis that we have here. And I haven't heard, as you were saying there very well, Tony, I haven't heard either Johnson or Jeremy Hunt actually answer this question of, are they actually listening to the public? And I like Javid. I thought he was a good candidate.
Anyway, we're joined on the line, I hope now, by Tim Gopsill. Hi, Tim, are you there?
Yep.
Tim, you, I know, have written quite a lot about Jeremy Hunt and his time at the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, which he was in before being Health Secretary. What was his track record like?
It was his first ministerial job after they won the election in 2010. And he was Culture, Media and Sport Secretary. And it fell into his lap an opportunity to demonstrate exactly where Jeremy Hunt's preferences were. What happened was this. Rupert Murdoch, a name that people may know, who was the owner of a whole chain of newspapers and of a proportion of Sky Television, put in a bid to buy the whole of Sky Television. The bid went for consideration by government, actually to the Department of Business. At that time, the secretary there was the Liberal Democrat Vince Cable, who had a more liberal attitude, and he regarded examining this takeover as a challenge, and he said so, unfortunately, to some undercover journalists, and he got caught out. He, in a sting by the Daily Telegraph, was sacked from considering the case, and it passed to Hunt. Now, Jeremy Hunt proved to be completely, can I say, corrupt on air. He had a very
It's okay, we just called him a liar. Actually, no, it was Boris we were talking about as a liar, not Jeremy.
The truth, and what happened was he was found to have had very, very close relationship with the PRs for Sky Television and the Murdoch Press. For the News Corporation, which was Rupert Murdoch's company, they had a head PR in London whose name was Fred Michel, and it later came out that they had very close buddy-buddy relations, and that Jeremy Hunt did everything he could to help Rupert Murdoch make the acquisition, and indeed it would have gone through in June, July 2011, it's that long ago, if it hadn't suddenly been exposed in the press that the Murdoch newspapers had been tapping people's phones, bribing officials and all the rest of it, and a complete scandal blew up, in which led to, people might remember, the Leveson inquiry. And in the Leveson inquiry, which was into corruption in the press, which was probably, I think, the most searching inquiry into corruption in the British ruling classes that there's ever been, ever, it was revealed, the documents came out proving this corrupt relationship that Jeremy Hunt had with the company. And if it hadn't been for that scandal breaking, Rupert Murdoch would have got his hands on Sky Television and consolidated his monopoly on the British press. People might know that a couple of years ago he tried again, and this time he was bought out by other companies and it's all over. But that was a great relief, but no thanks to Jeremy Hunt, who did everything he could to try and get the biggest media owner in Britain already to control yet more of it.
Oh, but Sky now is owned by Comcast, which is a US company controlling Sky News. I mean, surely that's even worse, isn't it?
Well, no, nothing like, because they don't own any newspapers in Britain. They don't have such control on public information and national political affairs as the Murdoch media did. They controlled the biggest newspapers, their biggest share of the press they've had for years, and if they completely controlled Sky Television at a time when the BBC's in decline and Sky was so awash with money. Sky makes $1 billion. Do you know Sky has more than double the income that the BBC does every year, and it spends hardly any money at all on programme making. But the power that it has is increasing all the time. So that was a bit of a let-off, really. But listen, if I can say, Tony, when I just was listening to this programme, you were talking about the NHS. Now, Hunt moved on from that job into being health secretary. While he was health secretary, he started didn't just increase the process of privatisation with people like Virgin Group buying health facilities, but he started this dispute with the junior doctors, with the hospital doctors, the most damaging and prolonged industrial dispute that's ever been in history, trying to stop junior doctors getting their fair hours, fair pay, and all the rest of it.
Well, just hang on a minute. That's a big claim, the biggest dispute in history. Compare it to something like the miners' strike.
Well, no. In NHS history, Tony. In NHS history. Because it went off for so long. There have been problems with nurses and people over the years, but to actually goad hospital doctors who are pretty, you know, these people work 60-hour weeks, who are the most dedicated people that the health service absolutely depends on, to goad people like that with all their commitment to public service into strike action took some doing, and Jeremy Hunt did it.
What about more recently on Iran? Because this is it almost looks as if we're staring another kind of Iraq type situation in the face. And of course, Hunt now is foreign secretary. What's his track record been there?
We might well be. You know, it's. I mean, this. I think this put this in context, Tony, of what's happening currently. Jeremy Hunt to commend himself to that rump of the population who are members of the Conservative Party, not Boris Johnson. That's who he is. He is not Boris Johnson. And Boris Johnson is supposed to be a wild and wacky and uncontrollable person, and Jeremy Hunt is supposed to be Mr. Sensible, Mr. Reliable, safe pair of hands, and all the rest of it. Well, let's look at him as Foreign Secretary. At the moment, it does appear that the Americans, whether they want to go through with it or not, are trying to provoke some kind of military confrontation with Iran. Now, in Britain, we have the problem with Iran of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, the wife of the Richard Ratcliffe, you know, the guy who's a nice guy, the nice couple, who's being held hostage, basically, by the Iranian government. She's been held in jail by the Iranians on trumped-up charges of espionage, when what they want is Britain to settle a long-standing, big dollar debt. And Hunt, like everybody else, agrees that Boris Johnson, yes, he messed it up when he was Foreign Secretary by saying stupid things to Parliament, to a parliamentary committee. And Jeremy Hunt has put himself across as he's listening. He's the sympathetic man. Well, now he is running with the Americans more than any other European leader. He's going with the Americans, backing their threats to Iran. What's that going to do for Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, one asks?
Finally, what about Julian Assange? We haven't heard a lot about that recently, and not necessarily with reference to Jeremy Hunt or Boris Johnson. But, I mean, this. Where do you stand on that, Tim? I wonder, because there are a lot of criticism of Assange over the years, and now it looks as if he might be extradited to the US.
That Britain has signed acknowledgement of receipt of the extradition request this week, actually. And it's going to go to the judges. I don't necessarily think it'll happen, because in the past the judges have supported people who are resisting extradition on grounds of freedom of speech, which is something, by the way, that Jeremy Hunt makes a big deal out of supporting. Just to come back, if I may, for a moment to Jeremy Hunt, in 2 weeks' time, Britain is hosting a world conference, which is very much being heavily promoted, of press on press freedom. And there are media bosses and people coming from all over the world. And Jeremy Hunt, at the height of the Tory party election, is going to be presenting himself on television everywhere as Mr. Free Speech and all the rest of it, despite the damage that, you know, big media companies are doing. But as far as Iran is concerned, he is not going to advance any kind of peace or justice in the Middle East.
Okay, Tim Gopsill from London, thanks very much for joining us.
No worries.
I don't know what you make of that. Maybe you first, Tony Carey. His record at the DCMS not particularly good, particularly with the Murdochs, getting in bed with them, effectively, and with their PR people. But also, we've heard a similar thing from David Halpin at the Department for Health. With Baroness Nettlestone, otherwise known as Virginia Bottomley, in his cousin, you know, and also she is now she was a former health secretary in the John Major days. She's now chairing something called Nuffield Health, private health. So he's very close to the people that want to privatise media, or certainly to get hold of it and to get it into their hands. And the same in the whole.
Well, I think by being in that family position, they should exclude themselves. I mean, if I'm in my role as a councillor, I'm not allowed in any way, shape, or form to promote the antics or the businesses of family or friends. I have to be totally impartial, and I don't think that is happening here.
I think it's interesting, isn't it, also, that the national press haven't really picked up much on these family connections of Hunt. I mean, if his cousin is chairing Nuffield Health, I think we should know about it.
I think we possibly would do. We still have weeks to go before the vote. It's a great pity that more people didn't see this coming and join the Conservative Party in the last year or so, because it must have been, the writing must have been on the wall, so that more of the general public could perhaps have a say. I'm, as you can gather, I'm disillusioned by the way this party's going, and I really feel.
So are the voters, apparently. Anyway, well, look, a final question to all three of you. Maybe you first, Anne. Do you think we'll be out by on the 31st of October of the European Union or not? And why? Why do you give that answer?
I was just listening to that interview and reflecting on it, and the thought that came to me is, if Jeremy Hunt can't negotiate with junior doctors, how on earth is he going to negotiate with the EU? So I have absolutely no confidence that Jeremy Hunt is going to be successful in going back
to
Brussels.
There is something farcical about his claim that he's going to get a deal from the European Union. I think everybody must look at that and say, well, you're not, actually.
Yeah, I was trying to be polite, but no, they're absolutely right. And with Boris, I just don't trust him, because he flip-flops. He talks about He said that Mrs May's deal was a disaster, and he didn't vote for it twice, and then the third time he did, when he came under party pressure. I just don't trust the guy.
Okay, so are we going to be out or not on the 31st?
My money would be on that we're not.
The best I can give you is I don't know.
Martin?
Then we're probably not. But of course, I mean, even if we were out, it wouldn't be the end of it. It's going to go on and on and on. We're going to be in the care home, the lot of us, before it's all sorted.
Why is that?
Well, because there's so many things to resolve. Even if, for example, the Remain get what they want and we don't leave at all, there's still going to be recriminations about that. And if we leave and of course, one of the real days, I'm quite blasé about this, because if there is a no deal Brexit, then there's going to be a run on the pound, crashing the housing market, and then we'll have a general election on the back of that, under first past the post. We'll see what happens with them. Bloody noses, aren't
they? Well, I'll tell you what, I'll have a little look at William Hill and see what they're saying on this one. Anyway, we've got a big event next Wednesday here in Bristol, and it's the rollout by Vodafone of 5G. That is this fifth generation mobile phone data network, which is the highest frequencies ever, the highest power ever, and the shortest range ever. So lots and lots of these masks going in, I would imagine, right now here in the city, all being switched on allegedly next Wednesday. The big concerns are safety concerns, and the major concern seems to be that nobody seems to have really researched this to see if it's dangerous to human health, even though we know that electromagnetic radiation, particularly microwaves, radar, and in fact some of the frequencies they're using for 5G are higher frequency than radar frequencies, and no one's actually tested it. So here's a little clip from the US Senate recently discussing this whole matter of how safe is 5G and how much research has been done into it.
My question for you, particularly Mr. Gillen and Mr. Perry, how much money has the industry committed to supporting additional independent research? I stress independent research. Is that independent research ongoing? Has any been completed? Where can consumers look for it? And we're talking about research on the biological effects of this new technology.
Thank you, Senator. I think thank you for your focus on the issue. Safety is paramount, and as you alluded to, we rely on the expert agencies, we rely on the findings of the FDA and others as to the requirements to keep all of us safe. There are no industry-backed studies, to my knowledge, right now. Happy to visit with you as to what opportunities you think there needs to be more studies, and we're always for more science. We also rely on what the scientists tell us.
So essentially, the answer to my question, how much money? Zero.
Senator, to my knowledge, there's no active studies being backed by industry today.
Anybody else know of industry commitments to back research, fund it, support it, to ascertain scientifically the health effect?
Senator, I'm not aware either, but I do know that with small cells especially, you're going to have lower power levels. And, of course, as from a carrier perspective, you want to be able to manage interference so that that interference is the lowest interference possible. So I would think that some of those studies or some of that information could be utilized in looking at health consequences, but no, I'm not aware of any.
So there really is no research ongoing. We're kind of flying blind here, so far as health and safety is concerned. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, that's a little bit worrying that there's no real interest in whether this is going to affect our health or not, Anne.
Yeah, and I guess it's
that is the US, but it's the same. I mean, basically, this is an international industry, and what they're saying for the US is the same is true here. There just isn't research into if it's going to affect our health.
If I'm honest, this has come about quite under the radar. It's not been, maybe that's the wrong word to use, but it's not actually been highly publicised or discussed, and I haven't seen any of the usual sort of announcements you'd expect with a new technology like this. And just doing a very quick search just now while we've been talking, and you look at the increase in power, as you were saying, and it's actually quite worrying. And so if the work hasn't been done, the research hasn't been done, then I think that is a cause for concern. But at the same time, you never want to be scaremongering, and we're conscious of the fact there is fake news, there is a lot of scaremongering going on with health in any area, with the experts telling us that, you know, things that you always thought were safe were dangerous and so on. So to be honest, I'm not clear as to what the health risks are and how genuine they are.
Well, there are various articles around. I'll put some links up on our show page so people can just at least understand this, although it doesn't look as if the City Council here is taking it seriously. I actually had a chat with the leader of the Green Group on Bristol City Council, Eleanor Cumley, who's a physicist, and she was completely non-committal on this. She said, well, I don't know one way or the other. I really don't want to really talk about it, which I found a bit surprising, because I would have hoped if there was any problem with it, the Greens would have been around that, but it doesn't sound like it. So is it safe? Does it pose health risks? There's a great little article in the Engineering Design Network website published in April this year by Larry Desjardins. He says his own conclusion is that there could very well be negative impacts from the electromagnetic radiation of 5G. There's enough evidence to show how a causal link can occur between these millimetre wave frequencies conduct to the interior of the body through the sweat glands. Bacteria and cells are affected by millimetre wave frequencies. DNA damage is a precursor to cancer. We know each of the above is true. Together, they may show a possible link from millimetre waves to cancer and other ailments. The key word is may. Also, they may not. However, these risks cannot be simply waved away as nutty conspiracy theories. And in fact, if you look at 5G safety, you'll find most of the articles are saying, oh, there's a few nutty conspiracy theories out there saying these are dangerous. Well, he's saying completely the opposite. 16% of the population will live within 80 metres of a base station for 5G, the distance at which cellular radiation showed DNA damage in the study above the same distance. It's unknown whether millimetre waves increase or decrease the DNA damage when they're compared to our current cellular frequencies. Anyway, so he's being... This is a very good study based on some of the existing research, and he's saying that there certainly should be more research into this, as the petition is, on the local petition on 5G. But before we hear from our other guests on this, we're going to have a listen to a Prime Minister's question this week, which was talking about brain tumours. And this is one of the things that they're saying, that this millimetre wave, microwaves on the lamppost through 5G could be causing this.
Peter Grant. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last week, a brain tumour ended the life of Sarah Wands from Markinch in my constituency. Sarah was 44 years old, a brilliantly gifted young mathematician and statistician, tiny in physical stature, but a towering giant if measured by any qualities that matter. Does the Prime Minister share my hope that funding for brain tumour research will be increased to bring forward the day that other families are not affected as the Wands family have been?
Yeah. Can I say to the Honourable Gentleman, obviously he's raised a very, very sad case, and a life that was full of, from what he says, was full of great promise, has been sadly cut short. And our thoughts and prayers are with the family of the individual concerned. We have been putting more money into research in relation to brain tumours. This is an important area. It is one on which my right honourable friend, the former Health Secretary, started some extra work being done within the NHS. That is continuing. But he's raised a very important issue. And as I say, our thoughts and prayers are with all those affected by this case.
Martin Summers, there's a lot of pressure, isn't there, on governments these days by the industry just to get these things in, particularly when the government are making absolute fortune out of the licences to license 5G.
Well, there is. I mean, in general, corporations have too much power in our society and they get away with stuff they shouldn't get away with. So we should be suspicious. But we shouldn't just, as Anne was saying, you can't just give in to every conspiracy theory about anything that goes on.
Should we be rolling this out without the safety test being done?
Well, no, I think that was very revealing, wasn't it? The interchange between the industry person and the politician or whoever it was in the US case. And I think this is another thing. The EU regulations are basically such, or the philosophy behind them, if it's not proved to be safe, we won't run it out. Whereas the deregulated future...
Well, actually, sorry, that's just not the case in the EU.
Well, I'm not saying that the EU...
What I'm saying is, Martin, I mean, maybe you're trying to make a case for the EU here, but at the end of the day, the body that makes the decisions in the EU is mostly an industry body. So it's the people from the industry themselves.
And
we've just heard they haven't done research. So Theresa May is saying there needs to be more research into brain tumours. But we've heard from the industry that
I'll try to be succinct. Deregulation, once we leave the EU, means that you don't actually... the EU is more regulated, and that is what the whole debate's about.
But we're not doing this regulation now.
No, I know. And, of course, corporations have too much power in the EU, Tony. I'm a socialist. I think the corporations have too much power, period.
And the EU, of course, is subject to far greater lobbying. And that the lobbyists are very, very powerful in the EU and have far greater strength than they are even in Westminster.
From the US as well.
And at Westminster. Tony, what do you make of this? Well, are you going to be buying your 5G phone?
No.
You can sit there in the street and everyone can see how cool you are?
Well, No, I'm not. Because I can remember having to phase out DDT. I can remember them having to phase out lead in petrol. Because these
so what are you, some sort of Luddite?
I am. I can be, if you want me to. Basically, my point is, let's do this. This is a good idea. Mm. And then suddenly, 20, 30 years down the line, oh my God, look what we're doing.
But you can download the HD version of Basic Instinct in 5 seconds with 5G.
Oh, whoops. Yeah, that'd be great. I look forward to doing that then.
Can I just say, from an economic point of view, if you remember what happened with WAP phones, yeah? They want to push this because they think it's a money spinner, and what you end up with, like the dot-com bubble, is in actual fact big corporations have to buy into this stuff if they want to stay in the game, but it doesn't actually make any money, and it's all based on zero interest rates, quantitative easing, etc., like fracking in the US. That doesn't seem to be viable except under the conditions, the bizarre conditions that we're living in now.
Okay, finally on 5G, we've got John Kitson, who gave a talk I think it was this time last week, or maybe a little bit earlier this week here in Bristol, and he runs a website called 5G Awareness. I'll put a link up to that on our show page, and this is what he has to say about 5G.
5G stands for fifth generation, so it means densification. It doesn't just mean higher frequencies, but it means more of the lower frequencies, and the antennas are operating on 868 megahertz, and it's basically, yeah, you know, we're getting a Wi-Fi antenna, an antenna giving off microwaves on every single street lamp. And of course, the thing is, with the antennas, 5G doesn't travel well. So my understanding of it is that if it's at this lower frequency of 868, it can then get through into our houses, whereas the higher frequencies don't travel well and they have more problems. So they have to incorporate these lower frequencies, that more of the 2G, more of the 3G, more of the 4G, for 5G to ride on top of.
So a bit sneaky, isn't it? They have a high frequency to do all the high downloads, apparently, and then the low frequency to get into your house. So the idea is here, Tony, is they're going to link up to all the little devices in your home, like your smart meter, that sort of thing. Have you got a smart meter?
No.
No, me neither. No, anyone here? Put your hands up if you've got a smart meter. Okay, no hands up. And this is supposed to be the Internet of Things, where everything is connected, and 5G is a key part of that.
Yeah, it fills me with horror, doesn't it? Because, you know, if something goes wrong, everything's going to go wrong, and then where are you going to be? I think the priority in the country really is to get rid of the poverty that we have in terms of connectivity to the internet, full stop. You look at some rural areas where they have no connection whatsoever, and that has to be our first priority, surely, before we roll out 5G. I'd like to see that as a minimum standard before we go anywhere else.
Well, some of our MPs who won't come on this programme, they say they're too busy at the moment, maybe a bit later in the year, I'll keep nagging them. One of them is Kerry McCarthy, and she was on Prime Minister's Questions this week, asking about autism and people being put into secure units well away from home who are diagnosed as autistic and causing total chaos in the family.
Kerry McCarthy!
On Friday, Mr. Speaker, a 14-year-old girl with autism and a learning disability was placed in a secure mental health unit 150 miles from home. Her mother's already had to stop work, and her parents are now trying to scrape together the money to find temporary accommodation there so they can be near their child. Does the Prime Minister not agree that we really need decent, trusted facilities in every community for distressed children so that families don't have to go through this?
Well, the Honourable Lady makes a very important point, and obviously the emphasis that we are putting in the National Health Service on dealing with mental health and on improving the support that is available to mental health is a part of this. We are looking, and I held a round table to looking at the outcomes of the review that we've had on the Mental Health Act, where exactly these sorts of issues about the type of circumstances in which people were being provided for was raised. And this is something that the NHS is looking at very carefully, and we are ensuring that there is a funding available for further facilities to be provided.
Anne Tarr, you're a candidate at the recent European elections for the Brexit Party. What do you make of this sort of thing? I mean, in this case, it looks as if what you've got is as a treatment for autism, rather than being taken to somewhere, a mental health environment where someone can be cared for. Quite often, people are and this is one of the scandals to do with these secure units, are just sort of pumped full of drugs, and they see that as a way of sort of parking the problem. What do you make of this sort of way of dealing with autism?
I think what disturbed me most listening to Theresa May there was that she was treating autism as a mental illness, and it's not. It's a condition. It's a way of life, and we need long-term solutions which will help these people have the best quality life they possibly can, and locking them away in secure units, just pumping them full of drugs, isn't helping.
Okay, could just very quickly, Tony Carey, any thoughts on this?
I'm echoing Anne's thoughts entirely. We don't understand why autism seems to be so prevalent, but we need to find out before we can start taking any action to resolve the issue.
Thanks to our guests, Conservative Councillor for Brislington East, Tony Carey, also from the Brexit Party, Anne Tarr and Martin Summers. Join us after the US-owned Comcast News at 7 as we go to have a look around the world.
Bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.